Welcome to the Theology Podcast, and my name is C.R. Wiley. I'm the pastor of the Presbyterian Church of Manchester, and I have my friends with me that have been with me in the past episodes, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
Glenn Sunshine, professor of early modern European history at Central Connecticut State University.
Tom Price, adjunct professor of systematic theology and Christian ethics at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary.
All right, so we're, as I mentioned, at the Corner Pug, and at the end of this broadcast, we'll talk a little bit about a Kickstarter campaign that we're getting underway, but rather than do that now, we'll just jump right into the topic of the day. A couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, I can't remember how long ago it was, Tom brought a book to the Pugcast by Roger Lundeen, and Roger Lundeen was a professor of, I think, literature at Wheaton College, and the book is entitled From Nature to Experience, The American Search for Cultural Authority. Now, my oldest son is a Wheaton grad, and my daughter-in-law was actually a student of Lundeen, and she had great regard for him. And a couple weeks ago, as I noted, you read something from this book that just captured my imagination, and so I said to myself, I gotta get that book. Let me read the portion that stirred me from the book, and then we'll jump ahead and talk a little bit about the theme of the day. But this is the section that you read before, Tom. This is related to Richard Rorty and his take on sort of the trajectory of Romanticism, particularly as it flowers in pragmatism. In Rorty's words, Darwin finished the job Galileo began, the job of eliminating from nature any purpose that transcends a particular organism's needs in a particular situation. In doing so, the English naturalist overcame the central conflict of Romanticism, which was that of the subject's troubled relationship to the object. For countless centuries, men and women had believed themselves called to reconcile their inner lives with higher purposes beyond themselves. Now, at last, they no longer needed to trouble themselves with trying to bring their longings as subjects in line with the meaning of objects. The object becomes, the object becomes an object of manipulation rather than the embodiment either of a telos or a logos, end of quote. Rorty argues, quote again, and truth becomes the expedient in the way of thinking, end of quote. Now, there are so many things that come out of this that I think help us understand sort of the illness of our time, the illnesses of our time. But one of those things, of course, is the loss of objective meaning, the loss of a sense that the world means something apart from my intentions for it. That there's no longer any sense, as Rorty notes here, there's no longer any need for me to sort of bring my longings and my actions into line with the purposes of things. Things are just kind of there for me to use in any way I please. And included in that necessarily is my own body. The closest thing to me.
Sunshine.
Great, thank you.
Welcome.
So the closest thing to me, and we see that is the case today. People don't look to their bodies, particularly in terms of design or anatomy, to understand themselves. They understand their bodies as just some kind of pliable plastic object upon which to subject their projects, their desires, and they construct an identity for themselves based on those whims. But anyway, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself a little bit. I don't know if you guys have anything you want to add at that point or at this point.
One quick comment. He obviously doesn't really understand Galileo, but that's kind of an aside.
So but you're thinking in terms of Galileo's sort of project within the framework of understanding creation.
Yeah, he definitely does not get what Galileo was doing.
But that brings up something, though, to kind of think about, and I know this probably bugs you as an historian, how personalities, figures come to be kind of emblematic in
right.
popular understanding, even though they may have been actually up to something very different.
Right, yeah, and Galileo is a prime example of that. I don't want to go too far in that direction. Just to note that Galileo made theological arguments. Galileo used scripture to defend heliocentrism. He had absolutely no intention of de-Christianizing the universe.
Right.
And, it's a complete misunderstanding of him when people read him that way.
But I do think it is relevant to what we're talking about, because we're talking about objective truth here. So what did Galileo really stand for, as opposed to what he's come to mean for us as a culture? And I go back and forth on it, because on the one hand I think, well, we got to kind of accept to a certain degree that people think these things about Galileo. And so it's almost like you have to at least sort of respond to those things. But you can spend all your time kind of fighting against the wind, it feels like, beating against the wind, because you just never seem to make progress on it. You know, we've talked about this before. You know, the idea that, you know, medieval people thought that that being at the center of the universe meant it was the best place to be, you know, in sort of the ancient cosmos.
Right.
And in fact, the outermost ring was the place you wanted to be, because that's where God is, you know. But modern people, when they hear that the Earth was at the center, they think, that means that it was sort of the best place, when in fact it was sort of like the drain of the cosmos.
Right.
But anyway, we're kind of going, drifting a little bit here, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on the Rorty, particularly the Rorty.
Rorty, it's interesting that he does kind of identify these figures with this particular narration of the story that leads to his project. And I imagine he wouldn't be bothered with that, because he thinks redescription anyway serves our own purposes.
Well, that's the problem with these people, right?
That's right.
You can never hold them take them to task.
That's right. That's that's right. And they
what was it Whitman said when he said I contradict myself? I contain multitudes.
So yeah,
I,
yeah.
I contradict myself.
That's right. That's right. And I think that it's similar you have with William James. He takes this same move, but he did it previously in respect to a pragmatic turn to religion and theology. I think his famous work on the varieties of religious experience, he goes through this first section listing all the classic metaphysical attributes of God. And then he says something very similar. Well, if this doesn't have anything to do with my immediate needs and my, you know, psychological functioning, you know, throw it to the straw. It's useless. It has no practical benefit. And I think that's right.
That's where we're going, baby.
That's right. That's right. And so, of course, once we get, you know, on that topic, we'll see exactly why those key doctrines like God's inner life, his metaphysical attributes, the metaphysical attributes of creation, completely shut out of the picture. Because they actually go against this whole pragmatic turn that has taken over the...
Well, and this gets me... It's a nice segue there, Tom. Gets me to the subject of the day, and that's the nature of language and how it's used, particularly in the evangelical world, across the board. It's used as a tool. Language is a tool, but it's not understood to be sort of a window into the nature of things. And that's a major shift in the history of thought. You know, you brought out James and his take on the usefulness of an idea. In the ancient, you know, way of looking at things, if something is true, it's just good to know. In other words, it's something to conform yourself to. It's not something for you to use.
That's right.
In other words, truth doesn't have to justify itself.
You
have to justify yourself to the truth.
And knowing is a conformity to the object, because knowing is a participation in the intrinsic essence of the object to which you're knowing.
Right.
So it's not something where you have this buffer to which you have this whole inner frame that is categorizing everything, but you are actually being brought into the objects of nature.
Well, let me read something again from Lundeen here, and this is a section where he's getting into James and his use of language, his way of thinking about language, and it's relevant in so many ways in the evangelical world, because we'll get into it in a minute, but let me read the this section. It's a couple of paragraphs in length, but I'll try to read it well and quickly. Metaphors of consumption, this is, I'm beginning, are hardly incidental to pragmatism. In one of the founding works of the movement, for example, William James brought the truth to market when and made the creation of it a matter of ongoing exchange. Quote, grant an idea or belief to be true, end of quote, he wrote in Pragmatism. Quote, what concrete difference will its being true make for anyone's actual life, end of quote. How will the truth be realized? In what way, James asks, will a person's experiences be different from those that he would have obtained if the belief were false? Quote, what in short is truth's cash value in experiential terms? End of quote. Truth has to do not with the relationship between language and reality, but the effectiveness and profitability of an idea's yield. Truth is an event in a process. Quote, truth happens to an idea. It becomes truth. It made true, it or is made true by events, end of quote. Truth is but one of many processes that are pursued because it pays to pursue them. Truth is made just as health, wealth, and strength are made in the course of experience, end of quote. Then, jumping down a paragraph, getting back to Rorty, Rorty builds upon this view. Quote, the world is out there, end of quote, beyond our minds, he argues, but, quote, the truth is not out there, end of quote. To say this, quote, is simply to say that where there are no sentences, there is no truth. That sentences are elements of human languages, and that human languages are human creations. End of quote. With language, we fashion a world out of raw feels of our experience, our pains, what babies have when they see colored objects, and so on. And out of our response to the merely physical world, the sun, the sea, rocks, and trees that surround us. The belief, this is the million-dollar statement, it's talking about cash value right here. The belief in a truth out there to which our language must correspond is a legacy of an age in which the world was seen as the creation of a being who had a language of his own. Now, what's appalling about all this is I recognize this particular philosophy in every mega church pastor I see.
Yes. Yes.
All of these guys are loose with the truth in the sense that they don't really think about words as corresponding to realities. They think about words in terms of how they can get results for you, how they can manipulate people and build their church or get people feeling good about themselves or what have you. There's no sense in which there's even a kind of an obligation to make sure that speech reflects reality. It's more or less salesmanship, and we've got something to sell. So anyway, I'll let you guys respond a little bit to that.
One of the challenges that I had when I was reading through these things is that my undergraduate degree is in linguistics. And one of the first things that they tell you is that language is arbitrary.
Yeah, right.
And by that, they mean there's no reason why a table is called a table rather than a mesa. I mean, both of them are arbitrary sets of sounds that are used to designate a specific object. And in pragmatic terms, it's hard to argue around that. The question that begs is whether or not whatever the particular sounds are that are being used, whether or not there are categories that exist that those words are actually pointing to. So in other words, what is the relationship of language to reality, and even reality in the Platonic sense of the word?
Right.
And the linguist doesn't get to that, but the emphasis is constantly on arbitrariness. And this was kind of a shocker for me because I entered linguistics having worked with Tolkien and Lewis quite a bit,
yeah,
who had a very, very clear sense that language, words, have meaning. and that there is a direct connection between the word and what it points to.
Yeah, I think you're getting at the heart of it. There's a, within linguistics, because it has a pretense to be a science, as opposed to philology, which is more kind of like a history of words.
Right.
There is this this sort of presupposition that informs the approach, which says that the world is necessarily meaningless, so therefore this is why languages work the way they do. But the provenance of any particular word can betray that. So one of my favorite examples of this is the word tree. So the word tree and the word truth have the same root in the word troth. T-R-O-T-H, where we get the troth.
Yeah.
So
it was, what you plight.
Yeah, right. That's right. So they saw something. In other words, they saw something in trees that spoke to them in such a way that truth, faithfulness, strength, usefulness, beauty, all these things kind of were easy to associate with the physical living object or the physical living thing we call a tree. A tree is like the king of the vegetable kingdom. You know, it's the most magnificent, longest-lived thing around. It outlives us in many cases.
Hmm.
So it wasn't an arbitrary act.
Another guess?
Yes.
Good at the moment, sir?
Yep.
It wasn't an arbitrary thing to associate this spiritual thing, truth, with the physical object tree. There's an inner logic to it.
Hmm.
So when you say tree, there are a lot of things that come to mind that you would say, yeah, that all applies to truth, which gets us back to this whole idea that of a creator and his word creating a world in which our words and his word, in other words, you know, the reality we know as tree,
yeah,
is something that he spoke into being. You know, all of its particularity, you know, all of its manifestations. But even in that case, we order trees by a kind of hierarchy of you could call it tree-ness, but I would like to call it just nobility. Like a giant redwood, you know, that's been around for 500 years, has more dignity than that fast-growing weed in my backyard that is sort of like a tree.
That's right. The swamp maples.
That's right. So we can say one is a noble thing and they're less so, you know. But anyway, you get my point.
Yeah.
The values are that we derive from our interaction with creation are not things that we read into creation, but we draw out of it. And the language that we form. Now, the problem that we face is we're so far away, we're so far removed from the natural world. I think this happens to commercial languages. I think it happened to Greek. Like, when you study Greek and Hebrew, because ancient Hebrew is much closer to the natural world, it has a much more onomatopoeia feel.
And explains, and it helps explain the closeness to the natural world, explains the closeness to the religious world, which explains why a lot of the analysis of the way terms function, especially in Greek, was looking at their mythological writings and religious writings.
That's right. Because
they were much closer to the you know, the contexts of use and much more alive. And
right. Let me give you an example of how evangelicals like brutalize language. Evangelism explosion. Okay, D. James Kennedy, fine man.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was a great dancer. I understand that he learned his salesmanship techniques because he was in the Arthur Murray Dance School. Okay, so that kind of gives you a little bit of background on that guy. And I'm not against the guy, but it was definitely a sort of door-to-door salesman approach to evangelism. But why in the world would anyone take use a word like explosion? The only reason I think you would use it is because it begins with an E.
It assonates.
That's right. But an explosion is destructive, not only of physical objects, but of life. But it never occurred to this guy that this might not be a good use of the term, or a good association with evangelism?
I think, being fair to him, I think what he was really thinking is an explosion is a rapid acceleration of heat and light.
That's generous.
That's a very generous take there.
So, explosions start at a center and move outward powerfully.
Yeah, sure.
I think
and
that,
destroying
that was,
everything.
Aside from that.
Let's ignore that.
Yeah. There probably was a subtle desire for him to destroy a lot of things in a way. I don't think he'd be wrong at some of that. I think he may have had that right.
but I use him as an example because I think that, or use that as an example because it's fairly well known and it's benign in a certain respect. But, whenever I listen to a televangelist brutalize the English language, I realize a couple of things. One is that no one listening cares about the English language being brutalized. Two, he doesn't care about the English language being brutalized. And three, this is in some way a negation of the very nature of language and of the gospel.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, you've got to go back to Logos.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
Word matters.
Yeah.
That's right.
Word, the eternality of the word, the stamping of that word's impress into the creation. The being made in the image of God, of course, has a certain correspondence to both of those things, both as creature and the word stamped within the creation, and its fullest sense in the eternal word. So, yeah, once we start severing that theological picture, then we're less tied to our language, and then we become sloppy with it. I'll never forget, I think it was Nicholas Lash, a Roman Catholic theologian, who said, theologians for a long time have forgotten that we're supposed to watch our words carefully before God. And he was onto this notion. He was always talking about the beginning of churches or services are so chatty. Everyone's conversing and talking. And the old contemplative attitude of serious prayer before entering worship and hearing the word has kind of become a lost spiritual practice. But I think they're related because it's not practical in the kinds of pragmatic senses to be a contemporary person flourishing in contemporary ways. It requires a sort of suspension of that and the entering into a different place before God. And I think this is also in the theological world because you hear it all the time. Well, unless the doctrine is going to become complicated, it's complex, it's going to, people aren't going to be able to stick with it, and plus it's divisive, and furthermore, if it's not practical.
Yeah,
and then they always have to throw in this is very practical whenever it's going to be a little bit heady. And I get why they're trying to say that, but a lot of times I think we're missing the point is loving God for God's own sake has a lot of practical fruit and benefits, our salvation and our eternity, but they're not the point.
Right.
And so what happens, we start functionalizing God and functionalizing religion to where I get something out of it. And so I think language is doing the same thing.
Well, it's a fairly sort of common complaint. It goes all the way back to Jesus. People are always complaining about Jesus and how difficult he was to understand. Why do you tell these parables? No one gets them. And then he would say things like, well, they're not supposed to. which really blew my mind before I became Reformed.
Yeah.
Because I had been told that parables were illustrations that took a difficult idea and
broke
made it simple.
Down.
When in fact it was exactly the opposite. It took a simple idea and made it complicated.
That's what is it? He came to open the eyes of the blind and blind those so they can see.
That's right. And then, you get to the very end of John and you see there, in the upper room, the disciples say, at last, you're not using figures of speech.
You don't need somebody to ask you questions.
Yeah. That's right.
But isn't it interesting? We remember all those figures of speech.
Yeah.
We remember those. Maybe the Lord knew what he was doing. But and I've always been fascinated by his wisdom sort of getting past the censors. Because, you know, we think about, you know, speech codes as being like a modern phenomenon. You know, they've been around. They've come back again and again and again. And we're just experiencing a revival of that kind of stuff. But Jesus knew how to get around the censors. You know, they were right on the edge of the crowd.
Yes.
Just waiting with rocks.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine there were times where he'd see the rocks in the hands.
And, you know, it's a fascinating point related to this, is here we have Jesus as the truth incarnate, the eternal word made flesh, and truth in the truthful correspondence of language.
Yeah.
You can't get a more complete correspondence. It's, I think, what Tom Torrance says, his being and word are one.
Well, it's what the first, you know, the first sentence in John's gospel.
Yes.
There you go.
So here is one who knows truthful language, and he knows, but he also knows, and maybe to be a little fair to Rorty,
I
need to be, because maybe what's going on here is they are actually, he is actually celebrating what it was that Christ was exposing. And it's the fact that behind language, if it isn't centered in logos and truth, is all of this other stuff hiding untruth.
Yeah, and that makes for an interesting segue into it, sort of what I wanted to get into next, because I think what naturally follows is the word games that we see sort of sweeping the church now. In the broader culture, because there is no sense of correspondence, because words are merely tools, they're necessarily power games. So think about it. If you really believe that words are just tools, then powerful people use them to manipulate other people to get things for themselves. That's the only thing that could be going on. They don't tell the truth. So everybody has to speak for themselves to sort of defend themselves. So I get that. But I don't believe the premise.
Yeah.
In other words, I don't really think that's what language is. I do believe that's what the curse is. I think that's what we see in Babel.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what we're experiencing is a revival of the curse of Babel. I think we're not seeing anything new. But when we get to sort of the word games with gender, the word games where, you know, you get into trouble because you make an, you know, there's a quote slip of the tongue, and the next thing you know, you're cursed and cast out.
Right.
And
everything you say has a code. It's code for some, you know, ill will behind it.
Microaggression.
That's right.
So it seems to me that if we're ever going to get away from this problem, we need a revival of faith and conviction that there is something out there, that our words do express, that it's not merely arbitrary, not merely, as you said. Now, getting back to arbitrary, you know, you noted the link. I remember Eugene Nida, he was the guy that was behind the whole dynamic equivalency movement, the Bible translation, which led to the New International Version of the Bible. And I've got a couple of family members that were involved in the translating of that, so I know all about it. I had long conversations with them. One of them was the chairman of the committee. So, but what you have, when you take that thing to its, you know, sort of logical conclusion, you end up with certain weird practices, like in Wycliffe. I remember hearing about, you know, the difficulty they had in sort of translating the word sheep in Papua New Guinea, because they didn't know what sheep were, and they had obviously no word for sheep. So they said, what is it like a sheep that people can relate to here? Oh, pig. Okay, so next thing you know, you got, you know, people translating the Bible into
the Lord is my pig tender.
That's right. Now, of course, there's a problem here. You know, the problem is obviously that swine are unclean animals. So you've got an issue here where suddenly now you've got a whole set of very conflict, you know. Now, when you get to unclean animals, when you're no longer translating John's Gospel or one of the Gospels, and now you're trying to get Leviticus down. how do you do that? Anyway,
my pigs hear my voice.
They come snorting and running.
Yeah.
But you see, so now it's all about. There's no. My thought was, well, you show them a picture of a sheep. is that so tough?
This opens up a whole series of other questions that take us way beyond where we are here. So, for example, the people who argue that you simply need to translate the Bible and you don't need any outside knowledge to interpret Scripture. The problem is, what do you do in Papua New Guinea where there are no sheep? What do you do in a culture that has not domesticated animals beyond dogs? You know, how do you deal with those kinds of issues? You have to introduce outside information beyond the text in order to make sense of it.
Now, this is why contextualism, mm-hmm. that sort of ideology, comes up short.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, this takes us way far afield from today's topic, but that becomes a real issue that needs to be dealt with. Because I think people assume too much when they make that argument. They make the assumption that people know what herdsmen are.
Right.
They make the assumption that people know what sheep are.
Right.
And that's not necessarily valid in other cultures.
Right.
But I think by way of analogy, I think that's similarly to the way, you know, Scripture and theology are functioning in the West now.
Yeah.
Is having ripped that semblance of creation out. These things are now, these terms and these ideas are being, you know, are working at with redescriptions. You know, as we talked about, for example, the shift from redemption to liberation.
Right.
And then, of course, we have whole schools of theology that want to make, you know, that kind of draw that out. And a completely this-worldly, immanentized view of a sort of social liberation is either seen as the form that true redemption takes until the end, or simply that's it. And so we almost are wrestling with the same issues of Scripture interpretation, theological communication, again, because we're not dealing with a theologically informed church or culture that still has its anchorage in, you know, some kind of historic vision of the faith.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you both know, the institution of the household is the rubric that has helped me sort of reconcile many of the sort of things that I had a hard time sort of keeping together when I would think about my life as well as the Christian faith. When we think about the generations, when we think about the sexes, but even when we think about faith and work, because we have lost an understanding that was sort of kind of second nature to people in the first century when it came to the household, we're left with a series of definitions and doctrines that have a hard time sort of holding together. So, for instance, let's think about faith and work, and I'll wrap up my thoughts on this. You know, we generally think of faith and work as sort of kind of holding together in a kind of sequential way, and that's fine. You know, we believe that Christ died for our sins, and we're regenerated so that we can believe that, and then there's, you know, the fact that we're justified. And then the question is, well, where does good work fit in all of this? Well, I think this is a fairly good way of thinking about it, but I don't think it's a complete way of thinking about it. We say, well, in gratitude, we obey the commands that God has given to us. But that still leaves sort of the nature of the work without some kind of justification. What is it for? So, in a household, when a slave was made a son, he still worked. In other words, he was working as a slave, then he was working as a son. So at one level, nothing changes. Work.
Yeah, that's right.
But there's an enormous difference.
Sure.
In the first case, he's not an heir. In the second case, he is an heir. In the first case, he's working as a slave. In the second case, he's working as a son for himself.
Hmm.
Because he's an heir of what he is enriching. So So there is no alienation. There's nothing to sort of like, there's no need to justify good works.
Yeah.
You know, the good works are really, this gets us to Adam Smith in a weird way,
yeah,
in your best interest.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of this, this again gets into some of the things we talk about in Kingdom Unleashed. The problem in the West is, oddly enough, given the tenor of the conversation so far, the problem in the West is that we've adopted a knowledge-based model of discipleship. That, you know, becoming a better disciple means going to more Bible studies and learning more and stuffing your head full of more information.
Filling up your notebooks.
Right. Whereas, scripturally, a disciple is an apprentice.
Yeah.
That's what the word means.
Right.
So you are learning to do something under the direction of a master. You're learning to do what the master is doing.
Yeah.
Therefore, the essence of discipleship is obedience in action, not knowledge. And that's something that people just, you know, in the evangelical church in the West, they just completely miss.
Yeah.
And paradoxically, there is a kind of knowledge that emerges from.
Well, that's what, and that's what we mentioned to Donovan last week. That's exactly what he talks about. Is the right kind of biblical knowledge is the knowledge that grows out of our participation in the living out of the faith. It is, you know, this is why, I mean, you think in theology, why worship? What is worship really called? The service of God, the work of God.
Right.
And why is that at the heart? I mean, that kind of connects the piety with our first fruits of our life in gratitude for God, but also the way that plays out on the horizontal. And this connects it back to the structures of creation, because that provides the structure for which living that out and learn and knowing inform the kind of creatures that we are and direct them towards our chief end, who is the Creator. Those things are all connected. And that's one of the things I think with, like, Rorty slips away from, and the contemporary church is often slipping away from, by ripping away the household and the image of God, and it's expressed in the family, and then, you know, the structure of the cosmos and its meaning. Another interpretation that has filled that arena, and now all of the biblical and theological material are being re-described.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a good way to end, I think. I don't want to cut you off, Glenn, if you had anything else you wanted to jump in and say. But as we wrap up, I want to return to something I noted when we began the podcast. We've heard the complaints about the background noise and so forth, and we have taken them to heart. And we're going to do something about it, and you can help. We've begun to set up a Kickstarter campaign. We're just about ready to launch it. There are lots of great rewards to those who want to give to help us purchase the equipment that we'll need to make for a better podcast. What we have in mind is purchasing equipment that will allow us to record each one of us and our voices separately, and then even record the background sound on its own recorder so that we can turn that down and turn our voices up and make everything, hopefully, easier to hear and understand. So, we just ask you to, when the appeal goes out, to respond and help us out in this way. But anyway, it's been great to be with you. Thank you for tuning in to another podcast. Our audience is growing. We're glad to see people are liking us on iTunes. We are being listened to on about a dozen platforms. I don't even know them all. But wherever you are, where you listen, if you can give us a good review and subscribe, we'd appreciate it, and share the show with other people. And I know you've heard that message a million times by, you know, other people who have podcasts and, you know, YouTube channels and so forth. And the reason why they do that is because it works. So do it. Anyway, thanks a lot for tuning in, and bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now.